Welcome to Truth with Consequences. Vince, last week we talked about Jeff Jarrett, Dixie Carter, and Vince Russo. I would say it was a really great show, but also talking about your childhood a little bit, but mostly that relationship, and we got deep into the Kurt Angle situation, which is very topical right now. Did you enjoy reliving all that stuff?
I enjoy talking about it, bro. You know, bro, I really enjoy talking about, like, the psychology of things and why people may do the things they do and why they may act the way they act. I mean, that's the stuff I really enjoy talking about, bro. And again, you know, it's like, Matt, I know a lot of times, you know, you and I, we go a little bit back and forth with, like, dirt sheets and stuff like that. And I know you don't even like the term, but, like, I don't think people really understand the position that I was in. Bro, there was such a depth of psychology and getting in the minds of all the boys and being a step ahead of them, knowing how they were going to respond and why, knowing what I could say and what I couldn't say. That's a whole part of the business that when you hear, like, you know, the dirt sheet writers, you know, oh, I would have done this and I would have done that and I would have cut the promo this way and I would have booked this and this would have been the finish. Bro, it's not that simple. You're dealing with human beings. They're all very different human beings. They're in a cutthroat environment. It's infested with paranoia. They don't understand, like, when you're in the middle of that, it's such a psychological game, bro. And when I get the opportunity to explain that and make people really understand, bro, getting in their minds and playing a psychologist, bro, was just as much a part of my job as actually writing the show. Because you write the show, bro, and you're writing the show that's this is what should be on the air. This is the best show I possibly could write. Now you've got to take that show and you've got to sell it to every single person on that show. It wasn't a dictatorship back then, bro. That's not how it worked. You weren't going to tell The Rock what to do and, hey, Rock, if you don't like it, there's the door. You weren't going to tell that to Austin. That's not how it was back then. These were seasoned veterans that had put in their time. They've been around the block a few times. They were part of the process. And, bro, selling the show was a whole different animal compared to writing it.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's one of those things that we've talked about a lot, the psychology of people, why people do what they do, and also for you, what your job actually was. And maybe for whatever reason, people don't really understand it. But I'll tell you what people do understand is if you go to russosbrand.com, you can get up to 10 shows a week and even more when you have a lot of contributors contributing. What is going on the Russo's Brand this week, Vince?
Yeah, well, Big Vito LaGrasso's coming back, bro. He's going to have his own show. We have another big name joining the brand in May. I'm really looking forward to it. You know, of course, guys, Castrating the Marks, Lions, Tigers, Bears, and the great Disco Inferno, who's back in the fold on Impact Wrestling, the Raw SmackDown reviews with Ben Hameen, Stevie Richards. There's a show every day, bro. There's something for everybody. Over 10 shows a week for less than a dollar a week. No long-term commitment, no gimmicks, no strings attached. Just try us out at russosbrand.com.
A dollar a week, less than a dollar a week for all those shows. And for those of you always looking for something to listen to, whether you're a wrestling fan, whether you're not, I've been a brand subscriber for a very long time. And it's what initially gave me the idea that I'd love to talk to Vince about some of this stuff. And one of those things I've been dying to talk to you about, and I even told you, my son and I had conversations about this way before I met you, was you returning to WCW, and it goes hand in hand with our previous show, Vince Leaves WCW, and the Radicals Follow. Now, the last time we left, I'm going to get the narrator's voice, the last time we left, Vince Russo, had sworn off the wrestling business, but you got a call and you had a meeting. And what, before anything ever, before we get into the meeting, whatever could convince you to come back to that environment? You had already built up some resentment, some anger about it. You were hot at Ferraro about it. You didn't feel you were treated right. Why would you even consider coming back?
I had a contract, bro. I mean, I had a contract and I had to live up to that contract and I had to fulfill my obligations to that contract. Bro, they made the decision to change the rules of my contract. And when they did, I made the decision to go home and I had every right to. They continue to pay me. So now, bro, they wanted to bring me back in what I thought was the same role. So I was contractually obligated, bro, to go back. And that's what I did.
In your absence, of course, I don't believe you watched any WCW while you were gone, right?
No. Uh-uh.
Well, things start to really get worse. And it gets to the point where Brad Siegel, is calling people in his office saying there's got to be changes. He's being more hands-on. The general feeling, according to the Nitro book, is that WCW was aimless. What was the reason, do you think, that they finally reached out to you?
Bro, I mean, Matt, I knew 3 months prior, I knew this is exactly what it was going to go down. Bro, I say this all the time. Bro, there are politicians. The wrestling business is infested with politicians. And bro, they'll stab you in the back. They'll bury you. They'll F you over to take your spot. But bro, what they don't understand is when they succeed and they're in that spot, then they have to deliver. And that's when they fall short, bro, because if they were capable of taking your spot based on their talent, they would have not had to use politics to get there. So the reason they use politics is because they're inadequate and they're not as good as you. So when they finally achieve their goal through politics, now they have to deliver. And 99.9% of the time, they can't deliver. And I knew that. I knew that when I was sitting in Bill Bush's office and I walked out. And in my mind, I was like, bro, go with Kevin Sullivan. Do whatever you want to do. They're not going to be able to deliver. So like I really knew, bro. It was just a matter of time. I didn't know if it was going to be 3 months, 6 months, a year. I didn't know what it was going to be, but that's what happens, bro, when you get ahead in politics.
Where was your mindset at the time as far as coming back? You know, you said you were being held to a contract. Were you in your head, like, let's say your deepest, darkest, real motivation, would it be more like, I really want to show these guys what I can do. I really want this to be a success. Or you're like, man, let me just ride this shit out and just.
Yeah, Matt, I did not want to go back. And I'll tell you why I didn't want to go back. Okay, bro. And this mirrors the WWE today. Bro, when Ed Ferrara and I were putting the blocks in place for the first 3 months, and we were slowly but surely growing the ratings. You know, we were creating the company that we saw fit. Bro, in the 3 months that I left, they completely tore that down. And I knew when I got that call, I knew we lost them, bro. We lost them and we weren't going to be able to get them back. I knew it, bro. It's the WWE today. Bro, you lost the casual fans. You're not going to be able to get them back. So I knew that going in, bro. I knew whatever I did the last 3 months were kind of like the nail in the coffin, and there was just going to be no way to get those people back. I knew that, Matt.
So the hierarchy of WCW at the time is that you had Brad Siegel overseeing the entire thing, more of a macro boss, but getting more and more involved as things are falling apart. And then Bill Bush, who was more in charge of the day-to-day. Would you say that's kind of accurate?
I don't think, Matt, was he still there when I went back?
Oh, no, he wasn't. There's a great
story. Yeah, he wasn't. He was gone, bro. He was not there when I went back.
But before you came back, that's Bill Bush was underneath Siegel, and he had the belief that he had the autonomy to kind of make some changes, and that was his job. So, as the story goes, according to the Nitro book, Bill Bush is making contact with Jerry Jarrett. That is going to be his answer. He's bringing Jerry Jarrett in as a consultant.
Oh, boy. I didn't even know that, bro.
Oh, it gets better. It gets really good, right? So that's what...
And, bro, let me say this, too. Can I please say this?
Right.
Bro, Bill Bush was a great guy. I mean, I can't say a bad word about him. But it was deer in the headlights, bro. But, bro, a great guy. One of the nicest individuals you'd ever want to be in the wrong position. But as a human being, bro, really a good, good guy. I don't have one bad thing to say about Bill Bush.
So apparently.
But I did not know that. That's news to me about Jerry Jarrett. I did not know that, and that's J.J. Dillon. That goes right to J.J. Dillon. J.J. Dillon and Jerry Jarrett were always close. Bill Bush does not know Jerry Jarrett from a hole in the wall. That's J.J. Dillon telling Bill Bush to call Jerry Jarrett.
So apparently, in a meeting, Bill Bush makes the announcement, Jerry Jarrett is joining us as a consultant. We're going to sign him up. This is on March 16th. Unfortunately, Brad Siegel had to tell Bill Bush, and according to Jerry Jarrett, he reveled in this, that, nope, I just signed Eric Bischoff yesterday to a contract to be a consultant.
Wow. See, I didn't even know that. Now, can you imagine? See, now, this is all news to me because I was not involved, nor did I care.
But this is what's going on while you're gone. This is two guys doing two different things. It's crazy. Yeah.
Well, not only that, though, can you imagine Eric Bischoff when Brad Siegel is telling him about Jerry Jarrett? Can you imagine what Eric is saying about Jerry Jarrett?
Here's the best part is neither one knew the other one was doing it. So Bill Bush makes the announcement because he has the authority to do that he's hiring him. And that's news to Siegel, but Siegel's like, no, I hired Eric Bischoff. So wow. Bischoff didn't know because Siegel didn't know.
Right.
Bush responded to the news, says Jarrett, by withdrawing into a fetal position on Siegel's office couch. Jarrett says, I witnessed his delight in reducing Bill to a sniveling person who recoiled to a fetal position on the couch. This is not an exaggeration. I can't recall being in a more embarrassing situation. When one man reveals the content of his character to a stranger, which I was, then perhaps I see the possibility of that character in his future actions. It was one of the saddest occasions I've ever witnessed. Siegel seemed to delight in the humiliation of Bill in front of me.
Well, bro, I could tell you this too, and I said it in the last show. Bro, when Bill Bush told me we're going in a different direction, Matt, he was white as a ghost. He was white as a ghost. I felt bad for him. Because I knew it wasn't his decision. And I knew he was manipulated and worked into that decision. I could tell that he wasn't fully 100% behind them. And, bro, he was as white as a ghost when he gave me that news. I've said that before.
Then Brad Siegel tells Bischoff, after he signs the contract, he says, I want you to work with Vince Russo. Bischoff agrees to give it a go. So this was Siegel's, I think, kind of his master plan, right? He's going to sign Eric Bischoff. He's going to bring Russo back. It could work perfectly. It could be this creative guy and the business guy, and they balance each other out. Is that what you think, that was Siegel's?
I don't know. See, that's the problem, Matt. That's the problem. That's where it all began. And I wish Eric himself would look at this rationally. This is where it all began, bro. There were no parameters set. Brad Siegel never sat down with me and Eric together. That meeting should have been me and Eric together, not me and Eric. He asked me, he never told me who he wanted to meet. He said, I want you to meet somebody at Hops, which no longer is in business.
So you didn't know it was Bischoff before the meeting?
I knew it was, but he didn't say it. That was my gut. Oh, who else could it possibly be? He never told me. I want you to meet with somebody at Hops tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And I'm saying,
what is
oh,
that?
Shit, it's Bischoff. He never said it. Never said it, bro.
That's some wrestling bullshit, because how can you not be prepared for a meeting like that?
Absolutely. How could he not be a part of that meeting, bro? And that's where it got off on the wrong foot. He never laid down the parameters. Eric's going to do this. Vince is going to do that. Now, I don't know what he told Eric. You know, Eric claims that he told him he was in charge. Bro, he never told me that. He basically said what you just said. I want you to work with Eric Bischoff. Not, I want you to work for Eric Bischoff. I want you to work with him. That's all I was ever told, bro.
Texting and driving isn't just a dangerous problem. It's deadly. And if you drive while distracted, you're 3 times more likely to crash. But far too many people still don't recognize the dangers. Did you know that when you send or receive a text, you take your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds? And at 55 miles per hour, that's like driving more than the length of a football field with your eyes closed.
Between 2012 and 2017, nearly 20,000 people died in crashes involving a distracted driver. And if your own safety isn't enough reason to stop driving while distracted, here's another one. It's also illegal. That's why cops are writing tickets to anyone caught texting while driving, and they're doing it to save lives. So remember, if you text while driving, you will get caught. You drive, you text, you pay.
You told the story that the only other real interaction you've had with Eric Bischoff was you pitched yourself to him to work with him, and he was like, we'll give you a call maybe, right? And
yeah.
That was it. You walk in and you see Bischoff.
I knew it was him going in. Who else could it be? I knew him and Brad were really, really, really tight. But I will say I walked in with an open mind. Because again, bro, here was the most important thing to me, Matt. Understand this. Matt, I had a 2-year contract for a little bit over $1 million. Okay. I was not going to put that contract in jeopardy. So I go in there with an open mind because I want to keep my contract intact. And, you know, Brad saying, you know, I want you to work with Eric Bischoff. That's not that does not go against my contract. If he would have said, I want you to work for Eric, I would say, no, wait a minute, bro. My contract states I am head of creative. I don't work for anybody. So that type of language was never used. So, bro, here's the deal with Eric. 2 things stick out without a shadow of a doubt. Number one, bro, the guy's just an arrogant prick. Like, Matt, when I tell you I have never met a more arrogant person in my life than Eric, I mean, bro, by a landslide. Vince was not that arrogant. Hulk Hogan was not arrogant to that level. I had never met anybody more arrogant than this guy in my life. That's number one. Number two, bro, it was clear to me, without a shadow of a doubt, Eric Bischoff wanted his job back. So I knew that was going to be a problem, that I'm working with the guy that doesn't want to be working with me and just wants his old job back at WCW where he could be in charge. I knew that was going to be an issue. There was never a three-way sit-down with me, Siegel, and Bischoff defining roles. It was never said to me, you work for Eric. So I just went on in my role as head of creative.
So what about that conversation? You've talked almost exclusively about your just perception of Bischoff as a human being, as a person. But what about that conversation? What took place in that conversation?
We never hit it off, Matt. We did not like each other from go. And I'll tell you where Eric's dislike for me came. His dislike for me came because I was in that spot. So right away, he did not like me because I was in his way of being in charge once again. So he did not like me. Also, bro, I'm not the kind of person Eric's going to like. I'm a New York guy, bro. I'm a street guy. I'm a meat and potatoes guy. I'm a get my hands dirty guy. I'm an honest guy. It's oil and water, bro. He is the exact opposite of Vince Russo.
In listening to 83 Weeks and listening to Bischoff and knowing people who know him, I have no doubt there's no reason why you can't get along. You guys are very, very different, but you're similar in some ways too. I think you both made assessments of each other. I think you both had preconceived notions of each other, and you both come off in ways differently than you want to. I think Bischoff and you are very similar in that you're private people. You keep to yourself. You don't have a giant circle of friends. He comes off as arrogant and you come off as kind of blustery and over the top. Is it fair that both of you were equally close-minded about each other?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, 100%.
You already saw the writing on the wall? You already thought maybe that it might not work, or were you just kind of working an angle, do you think?
Matt, yeah. There was no might not. Okay, I knew from the minute, 5 minutes into that conversation at that restaurant, I knew this is not going to work. 5 minutes in.
But there's no one to take those concerns to?
No. Because, bro, I wanted to fulfill my contract. I did not want to put my contract in jeopardy. We were talking about a lot of money. And as long as I still believed my role was head of creative, I was not going to put that contract in jeopardy.
You know, it's a shame that you two weren't the same age you are now. Because I think if you guys would have met now at your ages, I think you or Bischoff would have been like, well, this shit ain't going to work. And the other one would have been like, nope, have a good day. Nice to meet you, you know?
But yeah, maybe. Yep, maybe.
At the time, you know, you guys are still really staking your claim in this area. But you've decided jointly, I guess, to take a week off of Nitro to build for this thing we've heard about before. Someone referred to it as a big bang at one point. But you guys are going to reset. You said on WCW Live, we're going to come out with guns a-blazing. If this company's going to get serious about competing, that needs to start now, you said. Did you have any optimism at all about this reset?
No, bro. Eric and I worked together leading up to the reset. I mean, we met. We got together. We met in person. I'd say, bro, that like that first show, I'd say was 50-50. I can't tell you whose idea was what. I can't tell you that. But I could tell you we worked on that first show together. It was really, I'll be honest with you, bro, it was a collaborated effort, 50-50.
Was it a chore to work with him in that way, or was it okay?
It's not what I would have preferred. It's not what he would have preferred, but it was okay.
But if both of y'all... I'm going to get all Southern on you. If both of y'all would have had better attitudes, maybe that shit could have grown and you guys could have like done something together. Maybe.
Yeah, we could have, Matt, but I'll tell you what happened along the way. Bro, at this point, I'm wide open to it. I'm wide open to it. I'm assuming he's wide open to it. And at this point, it's a collaboration between the two of us, no doubt.
I think it's fair that you're both wide open to it, but you're both so skeptical that it probably isn't going to happen.
Yes, yes, yes.
So the big idea had been determined, according to the Nitro book. It's kind of what you wanted to do before, which is the Millionaires Club versus New Blood. And you guys reset pretty much everything. As far as the nuts and bolts of the show, you said creatively you contributed 50-50. What about the outline? Dude, this outline must have been amazing. Who is that, you entirely?
Yeah, Eric does not write anything on paper, bro. Eric does not write the format of the show. Or like, bro, the times I worked with Eric in WCW and TNA, he never put pencil to paper. I don't know if he did it when I wasn't there. I don't know. But when I worked with him, he never, ever put pencil to paper, ever. That's the grunt work, bro. Eric doesn't do the grunt work. That's the grunt work, bro.
And, like, it's, again, I think, the misunderstanding between you two is like you see it as not doing the grunt work, so you kind of see it as a little bit lazy. With Bischoff, maybe that's just not how he works. I'm more like you. I've told students who write songs, if you don't write it down, it doesn't count. Because if I don't write it down, it doesn't count. For me, it means I didn't do the work. But maybe there's some people that just are better conceptually, or did you see that be indicative of him being just kind of not a worker?
Bro, listen, there's merit to what you're saying, Matt. There's merit to what you're saying. But bro, with me, you got to get down in the trenches, bro. You got to get down in the trenches, bro. If you're not in the trenches, you're going to lose some of my respect. You got to be willing to do anything, bro. You got to be willing to get your hands dirty. You got to be willing to put the work in. If you're not in the trenches with me, bro, I am going to lose some respect for you. I don't play well with freaking authority, bro. I don't play well with people telling me what to do. I don't play well with people thinking they are better than me and above me. I don't play well with that, Matt. Matt. I love the summer because the summer means one thing, bro. It means music. It means concerts. And this summer, Shinedown is hitting the road on their Attention World Tour. Listen to this lineup. They're going out there with special guests Bad Flower, Dinosaur Pileup, and Broken Hands. You do not want to miss out. You will be blown away by all the incredible Shinedown hits.
And everybody likes Shinedown. I know I've taught, I did the best I can. But you know what? You don't want to hear me sing that. You want to hear Shinedown sing that, all their hits, and their incredible stage show. So make sure you are there in person to experience a night of rock you will not forget. Get your tickets now for the Shinedown Attention World Tour, at livenation.com.
Better than me and above me. I don't play well with that, Matt.
Has that served you well?
I think it has. I think it has, because the flip side of that is I don't think I'm better than anybody. I don't think I'm above anybody. I don't treat anybody that way. So I don't expect to get treated that way, but I know I in turn do not treat people that way.
The biggest story that comes out, maybe the biggest single story besides the overall Nitro that comes out of this night the world changed, which is in April of 2000, which is the first Nitro with Russo and Bischoff that is creatively ambitious. But the biggest story is Mike Awesome. At what point did you realize you were going to start writing Mike Awesome into the script?
Oh, the last minute, bro. We got him, I believe, like literally days before, literally.
And were you aware of Mike Awesome at all before this?
I was aware. Yeah, I mean, I knew Mike Awesome, and I liked Mike Awesome at ECW. I couldn't tell you his history at ECW, but I had seen him at ECW and I liked him.
When did you first become aware that Mike Awesome was showing up as a current ECW champion? Like, he was the ECW world champion, but he was going to be on Nitro. That must have raised an eyebrow from you on some level.
Yeah, no, it did, bro. I can't, man. I know Mike was in Florida at the time, and there was some kind of Florida connections. I don't know how it came about. But yeah, I mean, I knew that, of course, going in. I mean, but of course, you know, I mean, one thing about me and Eric, I think, where we're on the same page is shock value, bro. Shock value was not going to hurt that show that night.
When you're done laying down this script, when are you finished with the script?
Probably a few days before.
And they start hyping it up. I think people become aware of the situation. You know, they start hyping it up and using it in upfronts and that kind of thing. With you lay down the script, it's finished. Mike Awesome gets it at the last second. Let's take you to the day of Nitro. The day of that Nitro, do you have a talent meeting with everybody explaining what's going on?
Oh God, I'm sure we did, Matt. I don't remember this. What I remember most about that day is it was my first time like on camera, and I was nervous as shit. Like, bro, I literally remember having like dry mouth. That's how bad it was. You know, because like this was a pretty big deal, bro. I had spots on TV, on Livewire and stuff like that. But like this was really a big defining moment. I remember being very, very nervous. I remember Conan kind of noticing that and, you know, coming to me and kind of, you know, tell me, you know, bro, just go out. You know, I mean, he gave me, you know, advice and he gave me some pointers, which I never forgot. But that's what really stands out that day, being very, very nervous. I knew I was going to shoot with the situation, not the baby freaking 10-year-old bullshit that I saw on Raw last night with Triple H reading a letter from an attorney. Get the frig out of here, please. I knew I was going to go off on J.J. Dillon. I knew I was going to go off on the people that politic behind my back. And, you know, okay, well, you know, you guys wanted it, you got it, and you fell flat on your faces. Can we continue with business now?
Whose idea was it to put you on air, to write you into the script?
It was, I mean, bro, I can't remember details. I think Eric may have pitched it. And I mean, I was fine with it because like I said, bro, at that point, like I'm just so pissed off with everything that happened. I'm just like, F it, bro. Like the attitude I had at that time, I'm like, you know what, bro, let me put this attitude on TV and let people see this attitude because this is going to come off as real. So like I had no issue with nobody had to talk me into it. But I think he may have suggested it. I don't remember.
As you're getting ready to do the show, the script is done. Everybody's in place. Were you proud of it? Like, were you thinking this is a masterpiece?
No. Uh-uh.
No. Were there things that you thought you had to compromise on to work with Bischoff that maybe it would have been better if you didn't?
I don't want to say that, bro, because, I would have said that when him and I were going over the show. I would have said that. So I'm not going to say there were things on this show that I wouldn't have done if I wasn't working with Eric. I'm not going to say that, bro. When the show was done, I agreed to the show and I was good with the show.
Were you excited at all about the entire encounter?
No.
What about being on air?
No. Matt, you got to understand something. Listen to me. The experience I had the first 3 months were a living hell.
Right. I got it.
Okay. I went home for 3 months and got the same paycheck. Okay, bro, I got the same paycheck staying at home, playing fantasy baseball. Okay, bro, do you think I want to go back to this? Do you think in my mind I really believe things are going to be different? Matt, I'm not excited about going back. I don't want to go back. I don't give a shit about being on air. I just want to make sure I don't breach my contract.
You know, it's interesting, man, because you had Bill Bush doing something. The right hand didn't know what he was doing when Brad Siegel's got something going on with his left hand. At the same time, the main creative guy was Kevin Sullivan, who was being pushed out. He took it in stride. Meanwhile, he got the notice from a friend of his in Time Warner saying that his contract is about to automatically renew for 3 years. Go ahead and sign it, because the people at AOL weren't interested in wrestling, and WCW probably wouldn't be around for another year or so. Did you get any indications that you thought WCW's time was numbered on the TBS TNT networks?
Yeah. Oh yeah, bro. As soon as the announcement came with AOL, as soon as the announcement came, like, everything just changed. I mean, there was a feeling of this thing is going to be over. It's really just a matter of when.
Okay, so why though? Because when you go through the history of these kind of things, when Turner bought NWA and Turner at WCW, Schiavone always says they didn't care about wrestling. In this situation, AOL does the merger, and they don't care about wrestling. But wrestling is hot, and wrestling is giving them huge ratings. Wrestling is giving TNT and TBS relevance where they haven't had it in the mainstream before. Why is it always this go-to that they didn't want wrestling? It's never made sense to me.
You know, Matt, a lot of times, man, wrestling, and bro, the problem is wrestling. You know, they've created their own problem. Bro, people look down their nose at wrestling. It's, you know, a lot of people look at wrestling like it's beneath them, bro, and it's childish and it's silly. A lot of people look at that way. Bro, I've dabbled in Hollywood a lot throughout my career, Matt. That's the perception. And you know what, bro? I don't blame those people, because I could tell you, when I watch wrestling and I'm not involved, it is silly. And it is stupid. And those people should look down their nose at it. They don't take it seriously, bro. They just don't. And that's the fault of the people involved in the business.
So April 10th, 2000, in Denver, this is the night the world changed. The show starts with everybody in the ring. It's something that's been used effectively and maybe too much. But man, when we watched that on the watch along, and by the way, guys, if you want to see Vince watch the show for the first time ever, check it out on Patreon. When you watched on the first time, one of the first things we said was, my God, look how many people work there. How do you make that even work with all those people, man?
Bro, you just try to get everybody involved, man. You just do your best to find the role for everybody and get everybody involved, bro. If I'm a professional wrestler and I've worked my whole career to get to that spot, I don't want to be sitting at home, bro. I want to be part of the program. And that's how I felt. So I want to try to get as many people involved as possible.
The criticisms, you know, and the things that have hindered you at WCW, whether it be the politics, you know, and you spoke up about 3-hour Nitros, and you spoke, you know, there's a lot of things that you've been critical of, and maybe you brought to the attention of people. Did you ever say, there's just too many people here, man? Can we just like cut down the amount of people here so I can actually do this?
Matt, I never had the time or was comfortable enough or was secure enough to do that. You know what I'm saying, bro? Like I always felt like I was on a tight wire, bro. I always felt like I was walking on thin ice. I never, ever, ever felt secure in that spot. So I wasn't going to be saying things like that.
But by you not doing that, did that set you up a little bit? Because one of the things that anybody says about Vince Russo is that anybody who thinks negatively or positively about you, they'll always say, one thing I can say about Vince is he tried to find something for everybody, right? So how in the hell do you get 60 guys over? You can't get 60 guys over. No one can get 60 guys over. So is that something maybe you regret, maybe not speaking up? Because I don't really see how success could have happened with a roster that big.
Matt, I believe I could get 60 guys over.
You get 60 guys over.
I mean, I do. That's my mindset, and I believe that. Matt, I told you, bro, there were times at TNA when I said to Dixie, these guys don't belong on the roster. I'm never going to be able to get them over. Bro, there weren't too many talents like that I felt at WCW like that. I mean, there really, really weren't. I can remember specifically, like I said, at TNA, there were 10 guys like Dixie. They should not be on this roster. I didn't feel that way with WCW, bro.
But maybe you felt that way in TNA because of your experience in WCW.
Maybe. That might have had something to do with it.
Because, you know, there's a million people in that ring. And the show starts, you know, with a shot on everybody. And then Jeff Jarrett is the one to introduce you. Why Jeff Jarrett?
Bro, probably because, you know, just our ties. You know, I mean, our ties, you know, really more personally than professionally. But that's,
was it,
you know,
maybe to make Jeff Jarrett a focal point in this entire phalanx of 1,000 wrestlers?
I think more to kind of set him up as my guy. You know what I mean? Like the chosen one. I think it was more to really set him up as my guy, tie him in with me.
So it said in the Nitro book that you entered, even as brazenly as you wanted to look, you entered in kind of nervously. They announced Vince Russo. No one's ever seen you before. You've been working in the industry for so long, whether it be on the outskirts in a video store or with Wrestling Spotlight or with a radio show or with writing and then head writer. And then now all the attention's out on you. What are you thinking as you're walking out there?
I just don't want to F up. You know what I'm saying, bro? I just don't want to screw up. Bro, when I was a talent, my number one priority was I didn't want to make the other talent look bad. You know, like if I was in there with a Flair or whoever I was in there with, I respected what they did so much. I did not want to bring them down. That was really my focus, especially with Flair. It was like, bro, I cannot make this guy look bad. That really was it, bro. It wasn't about looking to get myself over. Bro, that wasn't important to me. I never looked at myself as talent. I was the writer of the show. But especially getting into that first program with Ric Flair, it was like, I cannot make this legend look freaking bad.
Now, we did the watch-along, but we did not listen to your promo. So I'm going to read you a bit of the promo, just get your reaction. I want to know, basically, how much of this is real, how much of this is you finally just saying some shit you want to, and how much of it is just pretty much primarily directed at, you know, pushing this narrative. You come out and you say, after giving 6 years of my life to the World Wrestling Federation, I came to WCW with one thing in mind, and that was to beat Vince McMahon at his own game. And you know what? Within a matter of weeks, the new blood in WCW was not only getting back in the game, they were changing the game. Now, is that how you felt?
Yes.
And did you really want to beat Vince McMahon at his own game when you came in?
Yeah, of course I did.
And here you go. And that's when the good old boy network kicked in. Afraid of change, and more importantly, afraid of their jobs. The political BS took place in the back to bring Vince Russo down. And you at home know who they are because you're watching me now. And then one day I'm told that there's going to be a change of direction, a change that I know sucked. And you know what? I wasn't the only one who knew. Benoit knew. Guerrero knew. Saturn knew. Malenko knew. Douglas knew. And they left. They're gone. Scott Steiner, he knew it. And they suspended his ass. Well, you know what? That's all over now. It's done. Vince Russo is back in charge again. And I want to I'm sorry, and I want to turn around now, and I want to say something to everyone in the ring. So you were cleared to say all that stuff? All that stuff was cool to say?
Matt, you got to understand something with my promos. This is a shoot, okay? Matt,
you're
never
just fucking freestyling, right?
Yeah, Matt, I never knew what I was going to say ever. Matt, never, never, never did I write anything down. Okay, I'm going to open with this. Never, 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 Matt. Give me the microphone. Let me get in the moment. Okay, where are we? Let me get in the moment. And boom, I never wrote down a promo or rehearsed a promo or knew what I was going to say from this one to everyone I ever did. Ever. That's, ever.
But that's insanity for your first promo, though, right? This is your first.
No, no, because if it would have been memorized, I would have screwed it up. I had to speak from the heart. It had to be truth. It had to be real emotion. If I would have tried to script that, it would have sucked.
So what would the script have said? Vince Russo comes out.
And Vince Russo promo.
And that's it.
That's it. I don't write my promos.
Did you have conversations with Bischoff or anybody about what you were going to say?
No.
So everything you said was just like, you're thinking, I'm really trying to push this product, but I'm going to say what's on my mind.
Yes.
And what, did it feel good to say that kind of shit?
Yes.
It is over. The old boys management is over. The inflated egos in the back.
You know what's so funny, bro? I got to stop you while you're reading this. This is freaking 2000. It's 20 years later and I would cut the same promo. It's the same way. Nothing's freaking changed. Good old Bruce is back at WWE. Good old Double J is back. You know, Michael, and on and on and on. I cut a promo 20 years ago that still rings true today.
I have a funny idea, you know. If one time I, on Facebook, I just thought it was funny. I took the speech that Kevin Bacon gives in Footloose, and I just copy and pasted it as my status.
Right.
And everybody's like, what's wrong, Matt? What's going on? Like, you could copy and paste, like, part of this, and everybody's like, Russo's going off. He's like, and then maybe a couple weeks later, someone will figure out, oh, it's that same
right.
promo.
Right.
But, you know, the idea is that you're telling everybody in the ring this, that it's over, guys. The old boys management is over. The inflated egos in the back, afraid to lose their spot, it is over. It is the dawning of a new day. It is your opportunity. Seize that opportunity. Vince, for someone who'd never done a promo before, that's pretty damn good.
Because it wasn't bullshit, bro. It's all bullshit today. It wasn't bullshit, bro. Freaking Heyman. Bro, you see Heyman last night? What bullshit? It's bullshit, bro. Nobody's buying the bullshit anymore. Okay, bro, and I knew that 20 freaking years ago.
And in the first, I mean, if we just count swerves in this episode, the first is, you know, over the loudspeaker, Bischoff goes, are you done yet? And he walks down the ring. You guys have a stare down, and you shake hands, setting up something that's going to happen later in the show. Were you guys going for that cool visual of you and Bischoff in the ring, both kind of representing two different eras?
We were just trying to build a swerve there where people were going to think we were on opposite sides, but we were together. I don't think there was that much thought put into it like that.
So then Bischoff goes on to relay the idea that he's on your side, and he says, those days are over. It's given me a lot of opportunity to realize mistakes I've made, mistakes like Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, Sting, Diamond Dallas Page, and yeah, let's not forget Sid, Vicious, but this is the real big one, Hulk Hogan. So what he's doing is really drawing lines here, right?
Yes, yes.
And then you do a little personal attack, and this seems like it must have been written in as an idea because it's out of character for you. You just started going off on Ric Flair. Ric Flair, you are a piece of shit on the bottom of my shoe. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to scrape off that shit and flush your ass down the toilet personally. So was that feeding into the kind of the real life thing where you left Flair buried in the desert and now you're trying to maybe make it a storyline that you really do hate Ric Flair?
It was really twofold. Okay, bro, the shred of reality in that was I knew Flair was you know, one of the ones feeding J.J. Dillon. I knew that, bro. So that's where the shred of reality comes in. But on the other side of the coin, now I know from a television standpoint, if I pit myself against Flair, I will put myself in a position where these people absolutely hate me. So there was a shred of what I was feeling, but I knew what I said about Flair was going to position me for people to hate me.
Now this opening segment finishes out with the Millionaire Club coming out, or at least a couple of them, and Sid Vicious is in there, and you guys are telling everybody have to give up their titles. And I guess on one side you would say, okay, well, that gets the point across as a total reset. But on the other side, that on screen, that didn't make a lot of sense to me. What's the reasoning for taking all the belts off?
Well, bro, there was nothing really working at the time, man. They had gone so much in the opposite direction in those last 3 months. Rather than invest the time in trying to fix it, we just felt it was better to just cut to the chase. Like, just like, let's start like the last 3 months never even happened.
I get that, but I guess now that I'm thinking about it, and we've watched it together, as I said, on Patreon, but it was kind of, they gave up the titles without a fight, you know, like maybe it should have been with a fight. And watching it at the time, I remember watching it, being excited about it, thinking it was great, always wanting WCW to do well so that I could have two shows to watch. That seemed a little, you know, incongruous. But the main thing that kind of took you out a little bit is when Sid didn't give the belt up immediately, and Bischoff goes, "What's the matter, Sid? You forget your scissors," which is just so inside, and so it refers to the stabbing fight he had with Arn Anderson years before. Was that something you guys talked about, or was that
Bischoff? No, that was off the cuff. That was not discussed or written. That was just Eric performing off the cuff.
Do you remember that line? Do you remember that line being delivered?
I remember it from seeing it. Yeah, when we saw it, I remember that from seeing it, yes.
And that seems a little out of place, does it not?
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
What is your attitude, you and Bischoff shared attitude or different attitude about the work shoot thing? How much should be real? How much should be reality? You guys aren't as far apart on that as people might think, right?
I don't think so, bro, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know, bro. I don't know where Eric is with wrestling philosophy. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know, bro. I don't know. I think we're probably more on the same page when it comes to that, opposed to opposite pages.
So the segment is over and the show is about to start. I think you guys got your point across about what was going to happen. You came out to the Road Warriors music. Did you know what music you were going to come out to when you came out?
That was my music from the radio days, bro.
Oh, you used Iron Man back in the day?
Yeah, I used a ripoff of, I used Iron Man on the radio, but then we ripped it off here at WCW. Yeah,
man, I can't even tell you, I am creating so many ripoffs of songs right now. For StarCast. I probably will end up doing a Road Warriors one as well. As far as drawing the lines between the Millionaire Club and the new blood, who did you see as being maybe at this time the people who were going to be kind of the faces of those two groups?
Matt, I really didn't have any preconceived notions, man. I told you, I would do so much stuff just organically, bro, and let it play out and let's see who rises to the surface. Like, you know, he's a perfect case in point. You know, a guy like Ernest Miller. You know, I liked Ernest Miller watching him, bro, and I thought he was great and he entertained me. But, you know, got there, I put him in a role, and he was going to take it wherever he was going to take it. And he was one of the guys that, you know, that kind of, to me, took the ball and ran with it and was very entertaining. So I really, bro, I never worked where I had spots predetermined for people. I never did that, bro.
But is what was your vision? Like, Bischoff's thing with you is that you don't really, like, have a long-range plan. And your thing is that you let things just happen organically. But for the Millionaires Club New Blood angle, what was the idea? We saw the big idea on screen, but how would you describe the big idea if you were pitching it?
The big idea was that the younger generation that were being held down were finally going to get their opportunity. I mean, that was the idea. And bro, honestly, the veterans became the baby faces. And like, that's okay too. Let the people determine the direction and then just adjust to it. Bro, I hate Eric's planning and arcs and Bibles. Bro, you can't do that in wrestling. People get freaking hurt. People can the fans can love somebody today and then not be over tomorrow. You know, contracts happen. You can't write it like it's a 12 week sitcom and these actors are locked in. You can't write it that way. It's a different animal, bro. There's so many variables concerned. You can't write it that way. Every time you attempt to write it that way, it turns out to be a massive waste of time. 99.9% of the time, you will go off of what you wrote. It's a waste of time, and I don't like wasting time.
So there was no indication given as to who would be the good guys and who would be the bad guys. You just thought if it, whatever happens, happens.
Let the fans determine it. Yes, let them determine it. Stay true to the characters, write for every character, and let them go out there and be who they are. And then the fans will tell you, this is where you need to take this.
So they're announcing that there's going to be a tournament that day with the winner facing Jeff Jarrett at the pay-per-view. And then we have a backstage segment where Sting told Hogan what Bischoff had said, and Hogan starts going, nuts. And the first match is Dallas Page beat Lex Luger to advance in the tournament. Of course, they had the Millionaires Club coming out with no music. With Dallas Page versus Lex Luger, where did you feel they both would be in the company? I know you said you didn't have preconceived notions, but you obviously have some kind of hierarchy set up. Was Dallas a bigger star than Lex?
I didn't look at it that way. No, I mean, Dallas was easier to work with at the time than Lex. But I mean, as far as, star quality, I thought those guys were equal in footing.
And late in the same match, Buff Bagwell walked out and kissed Elizabeth, which distracted Luger. So Paige hit the diamond cutter. We go to a backstage segment. I want to see if we can get through all these segments. And Kurt Hennig talked Russo into letting him wrestle Jarrett for the title match. Where did you feel... Did you feel Kurt Hennig was kind of underutilized?
Bro. He still had so much left in the tank. I mean, I viewed Kurt Hennig just like I viewed Bret Hart. Like, my God, bro. Like, I had worked with Kurt. Like, how do you not know how to use a Kurt Hennig?
Then we cut to the ring where Tank Abbott was cutting a promo. Of course, Tank Abbott is the personification of your exit from WCW the first time. He is ripping on Goldberg. So we're setting up Tank, Abbott, and Goldberg. And then he walked over to the announcer's desk and punched Mark Madden. He ripped off Madden's shirt, slapped his belly, beat him up. Was that something that Mark Madden would volunteer for or would not want to do?
Oh, yeah, no, he would do it. Mark Madden's a ham. You know, no problem whatsoever. Yeah.
Okay, so then backstage, you've made the decision that Jarrett's going to wrestle Hennig, and Jarrett is upset, and he's talking to you, and Russo gets upset and asked, and this sounds like you, by the way, after everything we've been through, you don't trust me? What do I look like, J.J. Dillon?
Yeah.
You're settling some scores on air, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Can you imagine if they let me settle scores on air today? Can you imagine, bro, what that would look like?
I think it'd be fantastic. So then in the next quarter hour here, Hogan found Bischoff backstage and asked him, confronted him about what Sting told him. Hogan is being played in a different kind of role here than he ever has. We talked about the way he was dressed. I think he had a jeans and a white t-shirt and, you know, Bischoff downplayed the situation and called Hogan into his dressing room. So you guys are setting up that Bischoff is going to turn and be with Hogan. And then Kidman came to the ring for a promo. And this was interesting because this is another super inside thing where Hogan had dogged Kidman almost, you know, offhandedly on the radio saying, what am I going to do, work with a Billy Kidman? But then Kidman comes out and goes off on Hogan. I remember one line calling him an orange goblin. I thought that was hilarious. What did you think of using Kidman as a foil for Hogan at this point?
Bro, it always is when you have that strand of reality, just a little strand of reality, and you can go out and cut a promo off of that. That's what's going to make the people believe it, because you're going to be passionate about it. There's going to be an underlining truth to what you're saying. That was probably the best promo Kidman ever cut in his career.
So I would agree, but I would also agree that this Kidman-Hogan match that takes place, you know, they just start brawling, is interesting because Hogan is really – really selling a lot for Kidman. You know, he actually blades at one point. The way that ends is Bischoff comes in another swerve, comes in the ring, laid out Hogan with the chair, which is when he bladed. And then Hogan and Bischoff count to three and then Bischoff counted to three. So the idea is Hogan is on his own here, or Bischoff is with you. What is the story you're trying to tell at this point?
Hogan's really on an island by himself, bro. You know, all of a sudden Hulk Hogan had all this protection and he was the untouchable guy. Now all of a sudden he's out there on his own. I mean, that's the contrast, bro. That's pretty much the story.
When Hogan, and of course the next segment is showing Ric Flair arriving to the building, another cut to Ric Flair, then a cut to Hogan where he's backstage throwing a fit. You know, even in this, Hogan's working hard. He's doing his best.
Yeah.
He's one of the greatest of all time. Would you say if he had a weakness on screen, the only weakness he had was sometimes he had trouble really being real, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. No doubt. Yes.
Sometimes this stuff seems a little forced with him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, to take, you know, say your prayers and take your vitamins, bro. He did that for so long and it made him a millionaire. So, I mean, it's totally, totally understandable why he would be uncomfortable in a different role.
So let's talk about this first hour that we just had. We had the big promo, right? We had Luger versus DDP setting up Bagwell, kissing Elizabeth, getting some stuff going. We had Kurt Hennig setting up a match with Jarrett. We have Tank Abbott cutting a promo on Goldberg. We have Hogan talking to Sting, but then getting in a match with Kidman, who does the promo of his life in the first hour of this show. And Bischoff turns and Ric Flair arrives at the building and Hogan is bleeding. That is quite a first hour, Vince.
Oh, yeah. Off to the races, baby. Off to the races. Almost as good as Raw was last night. Not quite, though.
So it's something we've talked about a bit. And it's something you've owned up to a bit, just in retrospect. But even though it's jam-packed, even though there's a lot of good stuff in here, there's a possibility there's too much going on, do you think?
To me, no.
So as far as what you're trying to do, your entertainment value, your vision, what you think people want to see, this yep. is something that once people tune into it, it's going to keep their attention.
Yes.
In the second hour, Ric Flair walks to the ring. So now it's time for his. So it's like everybody's getting a turn. You're really resetting everybody, and you're setting up a bunch of new feuds. Was that a lot of pressure to set up all these different feuds?
We never looked at it. We never looked at it that way. It's just kind of, man, when I wrote a show like that, I'm just kind of going with the flow. You know what I'm saying, bro? I'm not feeling any pressure. I want to make sure as many people are accounted for as possible, but I'm not feeling any pressure in writing the show.
So in this segment with Ric Flair coming out, Scott Steiner walks out and mocks Flair by putting in a pair of those goofy teeth. And then Shane Douglas comes out of nowhere and attacks Ric Flair until security pulled him away. You did in the first promo on the show that Douglas was one of the guys who left. You knew he was coming back. Explain to everybody why Shane Douglas and Flair were getting in the ring together when they hadn't had a feud before.
Oh, that was a big history back at ECW, bro, and I don't know all of it, but I know there was a history and there was a big feud, and I know Shane was always cutting promos on Ric Flair, so there was a little bit of history there. I don't know where it stemmed from, though, bro.
I believe it stems from the old WCW days when Shane Douglas was a young white meat babyface, and he feels and felt that Flair went out of his way to, you know, hurt his career or whatever. So when he went to ECW, and also in interviews, he would often go to that go-to of going off of Ric Flair. It's another example of you just saying, well, let's just put these two guys together. This is reality. This is what we want to see. Is that as simple as that?
Yep, because as long as there's that shred, it will come across as real.
A shot backstage of Kevin Nash walking around on crutches, and then a shot aired of Bret Hart sitting in the crowd. What is the reasoning of Bret Hart being in the crowd? It's almost the old Sting rule, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It would help if I kind of was refreshed on what they were doing with him for the last 3 months, but I don't remember. But again, just to make him stand out and be special, bro.
Well, you know, Bret Hart was injured, you know, and I don't know if he had reached the point where he thought he wasn't going to wrestle again, but he was injured from Goldberg kicking him in the head. And so the shot aired of him, but you know, you see that, you think, well, you know, Brett's got some stuff going on. Backstage, Gene Okerlund chewed out Douglas, who he said no longer worked for WCW. So you're making him look like an outsider. Douglas does cut another promo on Flair, told Okerlund to kiss his ass. And then we had Sting versus Sid Vicious, in the tournament. Sid beat Sid Vicious via count out. Dude, how much star power do you have here? Has there ever been this amount of star power?
Never, bro. Ridiculous, 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 ridiculous.
This match ends because The Wall walked to the ring with a table. Did you come up with the name The Wall? You don't even know, do you?
I don't remember, man.
What did you think? What did you think of Jerry Tooney, The Wall, as a future star in WCW?
Yeah, he had a long way to go, bro. He was still very young, still very green. But yeah, we definitely wanted to groom him into something.
Now, you have a discerning eye when you look at talent. I've heard you on your Raw recaps, your SmackDown recaps. I've heard you talk many times on Truth With Consequences. Did you get the idea that guys were coming out of the power plant not quite ready?
Not quite ready to...
Not quite ready for prime time. Like, coming out a little bit green. Like, they had a lot of talent that came out of there.
Not when it came to character and charisma and look. Maybe when it came to wrestling a little bit. But to me, they look like stars. And if they're not ready to wrestle, then that's your job to protect them a little bit in the ring and put them in there with the right people. But to me, if you look like a star and you act like a star and you're carrying yourself like a star, you deserve to be on the big show, and then you'll get better when we put you in there with better wrestlers.
It seems to me that this show has two different kind of things that you're trying to do in a big sense, in a macro sense, where you're trying to establish the lines and the characters for the older wrestlers, but you're trying to really build up some of these younger guys for feuds with these wrestlers. So we're finally seeing these younger guys hit this glass ceiling, and, you know, whether it be Douglas against Flair, whether it be Kidman against, Hogan, or in this case, after the Sid match, that Sid won because Wall powerbombed him, and Flair then came to the ring, challenged Douglas to a match. I'll get there. And then backstage, Hogan searched for Bischoff and beat up three count. Jeff Jarrett beat Kurt Hennig in the tournament, and the win gives Jeff Jarrett the title match at the pay-per-view. So he's going to face the winner of the tournament. But late in the match, Sean Stasiak walked out to the ring to to Hennig's old Mr. Perfect music. And Stasiak mocked Hennig by swatting the gum out of his mouth and carrying the towel. He's obviously going for the new Mr. Perfect. Why Sean Stasiak?
Oh, man, he had all the tools, man. He had a great look. He was a great athlete. He had a great body. He had charisma. He had personality. He also had a lot of heat in the locker room, you know, which was his shortcomings. But he looked like a star, bro.
Now, he was let go of WWE, involved with, I guess he recorded some guys. And then said it was a joke, or then, you know, but... So did he have the same kind of heat in the WCW locker room?
I'm sure he carried it over, bro. I'm sure he had a reputation at that point. I don't trust him. He's going to tape every, you know, conversation. So I'm sure he already had a built-in reputation that did not help.
I've interviewed him before. You know, he's looking for another run, right? You
know, I know. Yeah.
So, of course, Jarrett wins with the stroke. And then a shot aired of Hogan searching inside a skybox for Bischoff. So he's looking for Bischoff. And then backstage, Nash made a call on his cell phone and told the other person on the other end, get here when you can, I guess intimating that it's Scott Hall. And then they had a match with Ric Flair and Shane Douglas with you interfering. They both fought the match in street clothes. In the end, you walked out and hit Flair with a baseball bat for the DQ, and you also stole Flair's Rolex. Was it a real Rolex that you took from him?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. Yes.
Did you get to keep
it? No, I made sure I gave it back to him right away because I didn't want to lose it or do any damage to it.
You probably gave it to the prettiest girl at the Marriott later that night.
Probably, yeah.
What do you remember about that particular idea? You guys are trying to perpetuate the feud and keep it going. Why you're involved because of supposed heat with Flair, or, you know, you're aligned with the new blood. What's the reason that you come out in that match out of all the matches?
Just the Flair gimmick. I mean, that's going to be the angle. You know, me and Flair is going to be the angle wherever it goes. Because like I said, bro, me pitting myself against Flair, I just knew it was going to give me heat out the wazoo.
So then we have one of the most talked about segments in the show, in a show with a lot of segments. Kevin Nash walked out to the ring on crutches and called Russo and Bischoff both jackoffs. He mentioned Scott Hall and said he's sober and ready to go. And then Mike Awesome entered the ring and attacked Nash. Awesome took the mic and said when he heard Bischoff and Russo were back, it was too sweet to pass this up. Do you remember that being a big deal, Awesome attacking Nash, that whole thing, the whole fiasco that happened afterwards with the title? We talked about it earlier. Do you remember that being as big a deal as it became?
Well, what exactly, though, Matt?
Well, the fact that there's a couple things. One is that Kevin Nash is attacked by this guy who's this big star in ECW, but he's not quite as big as people thought he was. And, Nash in particular thought it didn't come off well because he was a little smaller than people thought. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I still think Mike Awesome had a great look, bro. I mean, I really do. He looked like an athlete. He had a nice build. So, I mean, I didn't feel that way. I mean, that's the first time I've heard that, with Kevin saying that. I mean, that's cool that he feels that way. But, I mean, you know, Mike Awesome looked like the real deal to me.
Mike Awesome is one of my all-time favorites. I thought he was really great. Why Kevin Nash? Why would he be placed with Kevin Nash?
Just trying to pair everybody up, bro. I mean, that's what we're trying to do at this point.
So it's another feud being set up, which is awesome, and Kevin Nash. And he gives him an awesome bomb. And then it goes to, before we get to that, I think we talked about this on the Patreon. He is the ECW champion. Apparently there's some legal action that takes place. He has to go and drop the belt. And for some reason, that's still not clear to me. Paul Heyman asked Taz to do it, who worked for WWE. So what happens in ECW is Mike Awesome defends the ECW belt as a WCW employee against Taz, who's a WWE employee, in an ECW ring. That seems really strange to you, doesn't it?
I don't even know any of that stuff's going on, Matt. I mean, I really don't. I swear to God, I people think like I ripped off ECW, bro. I don't even know that shit's going on. All I'm concerned about is our show and WCW at that point.
Outside the building after this segment, Hogan sat inside a limo and talked on his phone, and the white Hummer pulled up, you know, and this is an old WCW joke about who's driving the white Hummer that didn't get paid off, and slammed into Hogan's limo twice. And then Bischoff exited the driver's side while Kidman exited the passenger side of the Hummer. Backstage, EMTs loaded Hogan into the ambulance while Kidman sprayed NB for new blood on his shirt. That must have been a Bischoff idea with the spray paint, right?
I don't remember, but I'm just wondering if Brian Alvarez thinks that Eric Bischoff was driving the car.
So you would have a stunt driver drive the car.
And I'm sure it was a guy by the name of Ellis. Yeah.
And Ellis would be driving the car, but there's no candy glass inside the car, right?
No candy glass. No.
And this is effective. Stretchering Hogan is kind of a big deal. How much did you have any interactions with Hogan, or was that all Bischoff who just...
It was pretty much all Bischoff.
Was it still presented like he held a lot of power in the organization? Like when you were writing stuff, was it like Bischoff saying, let me run this by Terry and see what he thinks?
Yeah, you know, it was always that, bro, from day one with him and Hogan, man.
And so Hogan still had the power and the ability to just kind of...
Yes.
So why was he so acquiescing, agreeable to all these crazy, out of character kind of things you don't see with Hogan? Why this particular time was he?
Well,
so
because you know, I mean, you know, Bischoff's, you know, championing a lot of this stuff, and you know, I'm sure Hulk wants to make Eric look good. I'm sure.
The final segment is Dallas Page beat Sting to advance in the WCW title tournament, with Jarrett sitting in on commentary. Late in the match, Jarrett left his position and began talking with Kimberly. Page took exception and chased Jarrett away. It's like you're using kind of the same gimmick twice with, Kimberly. And then Vampiro ran in and hit Sting with his finisher. So you're setting up Vampiro and Sting. That's right. A natural fit, right?
Right, absolutely, yeah.
But you talked that Sting didn't really dig Vampiro, right?
Nah, because, bro, and like I said, bro, Vampiro just had a way of making things harder than they were, and Sting was very easy. So I think it was just kind of a personality clash, that's all.
This is always something I like, is when, you know, two baby faces are fighting, and then the heel comes in, and Vampiro interfered and hurt Sting, but DDP didn't see it. So when it's done well, it works pretty well, you know,
He's
not taking a cheap victory, but it explains how someone lost. Afterward, Jarrett came in. We're going to talk about this because we talked about it on Patreon. Jarrett ran in and tried to hit Paige with a guitar, but Paige ducked and Kimberly took the guitar shot.
Yeah, and wound up in the hospital that night.
Talk emergency room. A little bit about that.
Yeah, she really got hurt with the guitar shot, and Paige, had to take it to emergency. And I mean, he was not happy.
Talk about that a little bit. Paige is not happy. Who's he angry at?
I think he's angry at, he's probably angry at Jeff, and he's angry at us for writing it. I mean, so it's probably twofold. He's probably more angry with us for writing that. But bro, like I wrote the guitar shot a million times. It never hurt anybody, bro. Like, I mean, it never hurt anyone. I think this was like the first time that I can remember. So I don't think we put Kimberly in harm's way at all. You know, it was always a breakaway guitar, bro. It was just really freakish, man.
But also too much force, a small person taking it. You know, when you're writing this in, you said you've written it a million times. I know you don't remember the specifics of it, but is this something that DDP might have objected to ahead of time?
I don't think so, no. Absolutely. If he would have, we wouldn't have done it, bro.
Plus, you're probably not doing a lot of the go-betweening with this talent. This is probably somebody that Bischoff would be dealing with.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
With this guitar shot, when did you find out that it hurt her as bad as it did? Did you know it immediately?
Oh, jeez, bro. I think I might have found out the next day.
And were there repercussions of that? Were there, as far as, you know, Paige having an attitude or maybe them not wanting Kimberly to get physical anymore?
I mean, he was mad and he let us know it, you know, which that's, you know, that's why I respect Paige. You know, he wasn't happy about it and he let us know it. And, you know, he cut a little bit of a promo and, you know, we said we were sorry and, you know, we apologized and, you know, we were not going to put her in that kind of situation again.
In this match after the guitar shot, Jarrett came to the ring and cut a promo on Paige. Paige ran out and attacked Jarrett, probably, for real. Scott Steiner ran in to help Jarrett. So we're drawing lines here. Then Lex Luger ran in to help Paige. Bagwell, Wall, and Vampiro ran in to help Jarrett and Steiner. Sting ran in to help the Millionaires Club, but was outnumbered as Booker and Ernest Miller ran in for the New Blood. Before we get to the ending shot, that's a really interesting group of guys. It's literally, I think, who you want representing each group. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that definitely is fair to say. Yeah, a lot of moving parts, as Dutch would say.
But you've also got the right guys in there. You know, for the New Blood, you've established that Jarrett is part of the New Blood. Steiner is part of the New Blood. You know, Bagwell, Wall, and Vampiro, of course, but also Booker T and Ernest Miller are part of the New Blood. And then Sting is now aligned with the Millionaires Club. So these are still the same guys you were trying to push in November, December, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yep.
Did you and Bischoff have the same ideas as far as, you know, you're promoting a lot of these younger wrestlers to feuds with established veterans and legends? Did you guys agree about who the young guy should be? Did you each have favorites?
Yeah, pretty much, bro. But like after this show, it would start to fragment, you know, between him and I.
And on screen as well. But let's get to the final shot. Russo and Bischoff walked onto the rampway and shook hands. But and so that's the big payoff, is that even at the beginning you shook hands, it looked like you weren't together, and then it appeared that Bischoff had his own thing going on, but it looks like you're in cahoots the whole time. But then Bret Hart walked out behind Russo and Bischoff with arms folded. Bischoff and Russo appeared to fear Bret as the show went off the air. So Bret is kind of being played as the person who's indefinable above everything. Is that how you're looking at it?
Well, not really knowing where he stands, you know, with what he had gone through at WCW. And now there was a new regime in place. I think the big question mark was, where does he stand? You know, he was kind of eager to find that out.
So with the ending of the show, you said that maybe you thought, you know, and you're gonna let things happen, but maybe you thought it would be that the fans would get behind the Millionaires Club or will get behind the New Blood, but it became clear to you that the fans were going to be behind the Millionaires Club, the established legends?
Yes. Yep.
And would you have preferred it? Do you think it would have worked better if it was the other way around?
Not really, bro. I mean, you know, we let the fans have a say so, you know what I mean? And that's the side they chose. So that's the way we were going to go with it.
So let's get some reaction, first of all, from you. We watched this episode. Overall, you, I believe your reaction was you thought it was very good. You thought it was very entertaining. You wanted to tune in the next week. Looking back at maybe your most memorable Nitro ever, how would you describe it to somebody who hadn't seen it before?
I think it's everything a wrestling show should be, bro. There's characters, there's storylines, there's stars, there's feuds, there's excitement, there's reality. I mean, I think it has all the elements of what a good wrestling show has. May there be too much? Yes, there might be too much. But at the end of the day, you're not going to turn the channel on this show.
But much like there might be too much, and it's easy for us to say, it definitely seems so at the time, but looking at all the things you had to work with and looking at what your, you know, marching orders were, which is to reset everything, it makes sense. But if it was up to you, how would this thing have played out? As far, you couldn't do this every week, right? So you'd have to have matches. How would you see the Millionaires Club thing developing with the new blood?
Well, you know, bro, eventually the idea was to get the new blood over the Millionaires Club. But, you know, the things that changed that game a little bit was the Millionaires Club were becoming the baby faces, and some of the people in the Millionaires Club did not want to put the younger guys over.
It's interesting because in your first run in WCW, it's said by a lot of people, you know, that maybe didn't know you, that you wanted all the old guys to disappear and all that. And it's almost like it's coming true in a sense where now all these guys are going to have to put over these young guys. Did you have a better attitude about maybe people being on board with your ideas because WCW was in such dire straits?
Nah, bro. Bro, when people saw me and Bischoff were working together, they knew like this was going to be over soon.
A lot of us were hopeful. Was there anybody that was, like I said earlier, on paper maybe, you know, it's like, well, if these two guys can work together, you take the strengths of one and the strengths of the other, you have like a super wrestling machine between Russo and Bischoff. Was there any hope amongst you or amongst Eric or amongst anybody that this thing could extend beyond this, you know, short run?
Bro, I might have felt that way that night, but I could tell you, like, in the weeks to follow, like, no way.
What was the relationship with you and Eric like after this episode? Like,
bro, it turned into me doing all the work and Eric acting like the boss and Eric burying things after the fact and after he signed off. And that's exactly what happened, bro. Vince Russo became Vince Russo. Eric Bischoff became Eric Bischoff. And it was a nightmare.
Specifically, what about this show? What was the feeling about this show? Do you remember talking to Eric and maybe?
No, I think we were good after this show. I think everything was fine after this show, bro. Everything was, you know, maybe this was Eric's horse and pony show for Brad Siegel. I don't know. But as soon as this show ended, slowly but surely, you know, Eric turned into the boss and the guy in charge and the guy calling the shot and the guy that knows more than everybody else. I was doing all the freaking grunt work, all the writing, all the producing. And it was like, bro, like, please.
Wade Keller reacts to the show by saying just some things. First of all, he gives it a 9.0 on a scale of 10. So that might be 9 stars. He says Mike Awesome's debut kind of fell flat. Part of it, which I didn't know, was that he wore street clothes, and that was something that ECW was able to do, demand that he not appear in his wrestling clothes. And it worked against him because he looked ordinary instead of showing off his physique. Also, it said that maybe Nash isn't the kind of wrestler that can make Awesome look good, and Awesome's not the kind of wrestler that can make Nash look good. But that's a really a nitpick, wouldn't you say? That's kind of a cherry pick, right?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
He says the Millionaires Club versus New Blood angle is interesting, but somewhat flawed. He says there seems to be dozens of New Blood members compared to five or six old guys. Also, will fans identify with a group called the Millionaires Club? Portraying them as baby faces seems to put them over even stronger than before. This will bother some, but it will make sense to build up the guys who were stars so that when the younger wrestlers beat them, it will mean more. At least I hope that is the plan. I guess that was the plan, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He said in saying it's a 9.0, that the show lived up to the hype created by the returns of Russo and Bischoff. It was action-packed from the start and never seemed to slow down. Keep in mind they had weeks to book this show, but the question is whether they'll be able to book shows this week, this good every week. Still a great effort and a solid new beginning. The question's fair about whether or not you'd be able to do this every week, right?
Not really, bro. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind we can't do it every week.
How do you think you did on air for the first time as Vince Russo?
I mean, I think I did okay. Like, I wasn't, I swear to God, bro, like, I wasn't, the last thing on my mind was me being a character on the show. Like, that was not my priority, bro. And I didn't put a lot of time into thinking about that, bro.
Actually, I just realized this is on Pro Wrestling Torch, which is where I got the rundown of the show and also the review. But the person writing this is not Wade Keller. It is Jason Powell. And he says something about you, which is the opening segment set the tone for the show. Bischoff was especially good on the mic due to his tremendous presence. Russo, although he needs to dress the part, did a nice job on air considering his lack of experience. I'd say that's accurate, that you did a good job considering your lack of experience.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah.
What do you think about Bischoff on air? We laughed when we watched it together when Bischoff first appears as, you know, just this guy who just loves himself beyond. Did you find yourself wishing you could convey that self of confidence that Bischoff had on?
Oh yeah, no, bro. He's a great on air character, man. He's one of the best, you know, I mean, you know, like I said, bro, you know, years later, you know, I would tell Vince McMahon, you got to put this guy on TV, man, regardless of how I felt about him on a personal level, this guy needs to be a talent on TV.
It said at home, that Kevin Sullivan turned off the TV set, never to tune in again. Does that surprise you?
No.
So after this show, you've alluded to it. Let's talk specifically about what happened. You said things started falling apart. He started being the boss. Does this happen immediately? Does this happen before the next show?
Weeks. I mean, literal weeks. A matter of weeks, bro. Not a long time at all. A matter of weeks, slowly but surely.
Give me an example of how Bischoff would be where he would act like your boss.
I would write the show and send it to him. And he'd have nothing to do with it. And then he'd okay stuff. And then if he would read that stuff didn't go over to the dirt sheets or whoever, then he would call me and bury it to me after he already gave it his blessing. And that's when I really, really started getting pissed off.
Overall, were you pleased with the feedback of that first show?
I think so, yeah.
And when you're sending scripts to Bischoff and you're trying to do, continue this, what other kind of interferences did you get from talent or anybody else that made it, besides the Bischoff relationship, that started kind of unraveling this strong New Blood Millionaires Club idea?
Bro, I don't really think there was a, you know, like I said, some of the old guys didn't want a job for some of the younger guys. You know what I mean? But the problem really became me and Bischoff, bro. It really wasn't the talent. It was really him and I. It was getting to the breaking point.
It's said by Meltzer that the Bischoff-Russo era episode of Nitro was largely considered a major success. It sounds like, you know, you had every reason to be optimistic. When did things really start to get sour after this for you and WCW?
When the real Eric came out.
And when the real Eric came out and he's not doing anything on the show, how long are you able to kind of, you know, keep your cool and keep working? Where's your mindset at? How are you trying to produce this show? And what do you think is going to be the, you know, outcome of this?
Well, bro, I could tell you, I remember the point, like it was yesterday. We wrote a show. I wrote a show, you know, he put his two cents in, you know, with his red pen, like he always does. And one of the things, bro, and keep in mind, this was 20 years ago, bro, before UFC was really a thing taking off. We had created a specific match with Scott Steiner where he would compete inside of a cage. And like you'd have to go, I forget what we called it, but you would have to go be locked in that cage with Scott Steiner. It was kind of going to be like his gimmick.
Right.
What was it called?
I don't remember the name of it, but I totally remember that though.
Okay. Came up with a concept, had the cage made. Eric was on board. We did it. And then after the fact, Eric buried it. And I remember cutting a freaking promo on him. You know, bro, you know, you agreed to this. You were all for this. You were on board with this. Now you're burying it after the fact. Why don't you get more involved in writing the shows? Blah, 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 blah. I let it fly. I remember throwing my phone in my house. And I remember my next call was to Brad Siegel. And my call was, bro, it's him or me. Like, seriously, Brad, I can't work with an arrogant guy like this. I'm sorry. He's freaking arrogant, bro. He don't want to get in the trenches. He's above it all. He's better than me. Bro, pick one. Pick a side, Brad. Pick a freaking side. Okay, bro? And if it's him, great. It's him. I don't give a shit. So emergency meeting called for this. This is the first time the three of us are together
ever.
I had to fly out to LA to meet with Brad and freaking Eric. And I said I think we were in a trailer or something. I said exactly what I just said. Exactly, bro. I'm sick. I'm sick of this guy, you know, being the boss, not doing the work, not getting in the trenches, not getting his hands dirty, you know, criticizing stuff after the fact. I'm sick of it, Brad. So listen, I got a great idea. Let Eric write the freaking show. That simple. Let Eric write the show. And bro, I got to tell you, Brad Siegel did the back pedal. Brad Siegel knew, bro, and Eric Bischoff knew he's not capable of writing a show. And Brad Siegel knows he's not capable of writing a show. Bro, then that's fine. If you're not capable of writing a show, let me write the show and quit acting so goddamn arrogant. Okay, pardon my French. Okay, you know you're not capable of writing a show. You know you're not capable of doing what I'm doing. Brad Siegel knows Eric Bischoff's not capable of doing a show. So the minute I say, let Eric write the show, they both know Eric can't write the show.
So we're going to stop the story right there because the story that continues from there has to.
And I said GD and I got to apologize for that. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. No, it happens to the best of us. So the story that continues from there is the Bash of the Beach 2000 story. And there's also another story that we're going to tell another episode.
That was, bro, we had the meeting in the trailer. Brad Siegel said, Vince, you are writing the show and Eric is hands off. The next show was Bash at the Beach.
And that is what we're going to talk about. I do want to put a little bow on this with a couple things. Another situation that occurs is on the following Thunder from The Night That Changed the World is the first appearance by one David Arquette. And we're going to talk about that another time. Overall, with this this episode that was considered a success that everybody still remembers, by the way. Who else was on the creative talent? Was Ferrara still there?
No, me and Eric did this show by ourselves. Nobody else was involved.
Well, I guess all in all, not a bad team for one night, huh?
Not for one night, not bad at all.
We'll see you next week on Truth with Consequence. Let me say that again, because they don't see us next week. Make sure to listen again next week to Vince Russo's Truth with Consequences.